All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Saturday, November 14th, 2020. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I've appeared on as a guest. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to The Barnes Review, the bi-monthly historical revisionist magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all of the details. All right, with that said, let me introduce our special guest this morning. Fred Leuchter is joining us for the very first time. Fred, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me on, John.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you very much for joining me. It's quite an honor, actually. I've been tremendously influenced by your work, as have thousands, millions of others. You're kind of known as one of the original revisionists, I think, looking back at the movement historically, I guess. So just to get started, can you kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, give us a little bit of background information, and kind of explain how you got into the revisionist scene, so to speak?
Okay, well, at this point, I'm a retired engineer. I began my career back in the 60s. I was designing photographic and navigational equipment. I did a considerable amount of work for the Navy and also for the Air Force. I was asked by my father worked for the Department of Correction here in Massachusetts, and I was asked by the by an official at the Department of Correction to take a look at their electric chair, because the state of Massachusetts had reinstated the death penalty, and I looked at it. The chair certainly needed some work because it was quite antiquated. But as usual, the states take their time when they move on these things, because there was nobody going to be executed in the near future. But my name was passed around. I was given to the other states, and before long, I had all of the states contacting me. I started making electrocution equipment, and then I was asked by the state of New Jersey to design a lethal injection machine, and I was also asked to deal with the hanging problem. I wrote the protocol for hanging that's presently used, and I was also involved in gas chamber design and repair, both for the state of Mississippi and for the state of Missouri. So I kind of ran the gamut. I was asked by these states to come in because they hadn't used their execution equipment in some 25 or 30 years, and some longer than that. And most of it was antiquated. It didn't work. The gas chambers were leaking. The electric chairs weren't functional. So I kind of come into a situation where nothing was functional. And that's, I guess, where I am at this point. I was asked by Robert Forreson, who was one of the top revisionists, who was working with Ernst Zundel on Ernst Zundel's second trial, after having been recommended by several states that have capital punishment here in the United States. I was asked to go to Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Majdanek to examine the facilities there and make a determination if they were or could have been gas chambers. I did that, and of course, the rest is history. They weren't and couldn't have been.
Yeah, very interesting. So your professional work, this was taking place in the 70s and the 80s, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And then the Zundel trial, that was, of course, in the late 80s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So you were basically contracted to go over to Auschwitz to investigate, you know, given your professional background. And so this was in the late 80s as well, when you went over there originally?
Yes.
Okay.
You, I was, because I was manufacturing execution equipment, when there was a problem in the United States with an execution, I was generally called in by one or the other of the parties of the state, or generally I was working for the state who was suing itself to make sure that the execution equipment was functional. And I was certified as an expert witness in the federal court system and the state court systems here in the United States. I subsequently was certified as an expert witness in the Canadian court system. And then because of the situation in Europe with Ernst Zundel, I was certified in the German court system.
Okay, very interesting. Now, prior to being contacted by Farisan, had you ever thought much about the alleged Jewish Holocaust, or were you sympathetic to the revisionist cause, or what was your sort of mindset going into this endeavor?
I didn't know that much about it. I mean, when I went to school, the Holocaust wasn't a big thing and it wasn't taught. But by the same token, I mean, I assumed that it happened because it was supposedly a matter of history. And when I got to Poland and I saw what was there, I was just totally amazed because it turned out to be a big joke. None of this stuff ever could have happened.
Okay, so you basically were you familiar with like the revisionist talking points or like the points that they were making about the alleged Holocaust, particularly as it relates to Auschwitz, I guess. But I mean, were you familiar with their sort of line of thinking?
Not really. I was trained from the ground up. When I worked for Ernst Zundel, I was given a ton of material. I had to consume a ton of reading before I went. I had to talk with a ton of experts before I went, even to the extent of I talked to the chief chemist for DuPont, for the division that made hydrogen cyanide, so I would understand what I was looking for and what I was examining for when I went to the concentration camps. I was of course an expert in terms of executions going bad and what the requirements were for good equipment, but I wasn't familiar with crematories. And I spent 2 weeks here in Massachusetts working at a crematory, cremating bodies and grinding bones. I was schooled in the chemistry necessary to know what was going on with the residual hydrogen cyanide or Prussian blue that was left in the concentration camps in the delousing facilities. And that's how I determined that there was no gas left. There was no residue from the gas left at any of the alleged execution facilities.
Interesting. Okay. So, you know what, can you actually kind of walk us through what took, your investigation into the Auschwitz alleged death camp? Can you kind of just walk us through step by step? How long were you there? What were you looking for? What sort of forensic investigations did you conduct?
Well, we were there, I guess, just under 2 weeks. I had quite an entourage with me because I had most of the, with the exception, my group was myself, my draftsman, and also my wife came with us. I had just been recently married. We were only married for a couple of weeks when we went. A lot of people that came from Canada, many of them were former German nationals, but they were people who were experts that had been to Auschwitz and the concentration camps before and knew what to show me. When we arrived at Auschwitz, they took me to the alleged gas chamber at Auschwitz I, or the main camp. And I remember standing inside it. I said, okay, gentlemen, where's the gas chamber? And they said to me, you're in it. And I kind of looked at them. I said, oh, cut the joking. Show me where the gas chamber is. And they said, this is it. And I just was totally amazed because I was standing in the middle of a morgue that could not possibly have been used for a gas chamber. I mean, it was ridiculous. There was no, there were no seals on the doors. The catch basin and sewer system of the camp went from the floor. Naturally, a morgue where they do autopsies, they washed everything down. The water went through. They washed the floor. The water went down into the sewer and it'll come up into the sewer system in the middle of the camp. If you had utilized gas there, you would the gas would have wound up coming up in the commandant's toilet, which was across the street from the alleged gas chamber. So, I mean, I was just totally amazed. I mean, I knew what a gas chamber was like. I designed one for the state of Missouri from the ground up, and it certainly wasn't anything like what I saw when I got to Auschwitz. We later on went on to Majdanek, and then we went to Birkenau first, and then to Majdanek, and I saw nothing at these locations that could have ever been utilized as a gas execution facility. It was just a big joke. And I was just totally amazed, and I was a little annoyed because they've been stuffing this down everybody's throat for the last 25 or 30 years, and I'm in the middle of it, and I said, none of this stuff, it's a lie. It can't work.
Okay, so then what exactly, you said, they brought you into the quote-unquote, gas chamber, and it was basically just a morgue. So is that all that was really going on at Auschwitz? I mean, could you kind of give us... What do you think was actually taking place there then, if it wasn't this gas chamber and sort of a death camp, so to speak?
Well, Auschwitz, it was a labor camp. It was adjacent to the IG Farben Buna rubber facility. They made all of the artificial rubber that was used by the Germans during the war. Now, the Allies had totally cut off Germany from getting any chicle from the Far East. There was no means of them getting any rubber, so they had to manufacture the rubber out of a byproduct from the coal. They destructively distilled coal. The chemicals that were resulted from this, which is similar to oil, they made gasoline out of it, and they also made rubber. This rubber kept all the German tanks moving. It kept all the German vehicles moving. It made the tires. It kept all the aircraft moving. It supplied the gaskets for everything. Without the Buna rubber factory, Germany would have lost the war before it started. So that's primarily what they were doing there at Auschwitz. The facility, as far as I could see, I mean, there was a swimming pool for the inmates, and they try to keep everybody happy because they needed a happy workforce for the workers that were going out every day to work at the factory and then come back. It certainly wasn't a death camp. It was a labor camp, and I don't think anybody being held in a concentration camp, which is a kind of a prison, and then taken out every day to work and brought back, I don't think that's a particularly good thing, and I certainly wouldn't like it. But, I mean, we did the same thing here in the United States to Japanese and Chinese, where we put them in concentration camps. The only difference is we didn't make them work. But unfortunately, our people here in this country couldn't tell the difference in a Chinese and a Japanese because we put them all together in the same concentration camps here in the mid and the far west. But Auschwitz was a work camp. It certainly wasn't anything else. Now, there were also other camps, which are transit camps. And these camps, they really didn't even have people staying there overnight. They had barracks in case somebody was delayed on where they went, but the people who wound up in the labor camps were brought through the so-called transit camps, and they were it was a railhead, and they were shipped out to the other labor facilities where they were going to work.
And Auschwitz was probably one of the biggest, sort of labor concentration camps, correct? Out of all the networks, yeah.
Right. Most likely it was the biggest, and it housed the more people at any one time, yes.
Yeah, and see, that's the thing. I mean, that makes a lot more sense. And Guillermo Rudolph was recently on just last week, explaining like what Auschwitz really was. Right. And one of his main points was that the German authorities, at the top level just really didn't have, a plan. They just couldn't really – adequately keep all these people there. They were just bombarded with people that they weren't really prepared for. What was your take on that? I know there's some comments on, you know, on that podcast. So could you, go ahead.
I listened in detail to the interview with Gamar, and, you know, I really feel sorry for Gamar because, there's a number of problems here. Gamma, although he agrees totally with my report on what I found and how I testified in court, Gamma doesn't understand what I was hired to do. His point of view is a little different than mine. Gamar is a chemist, and he's a PhD. He's not a hands-on engineer, and he's not used to building anything. I was hired by the court, and I was and by Zundel's defense team, and I was sent there because I was an expert on gas chambers, and I was to determine whether or not there were or could have been any workable gas chambers. My job wasn't to deal with the chemistry of the location, although I was briefed, and I was thoroughly briefed by Dr. Lindsay on how the chemicals would remain in the environment for thousands of years after the use of the hydrogen cyanide gas. And I found this in all of the facilities that were made for delousing. The situation there was that I was sent to evaluate these things from a mechanical standpoint on how gas chambers would work. Subsequent additional to that, my knowledge of how the gas and the prussic acid combined and remained in the environment afterward, I brought back samples taken from the various facilities. Control sample was taken from the delousing facility, and the other samples were taken from the alleged gas chambers. And the samples, when they were reviewed, showed that there was almost no gas in the alleged facilities where the gas chambers were supposed to have been, but there was a major residue left in the delousing facilities. And this was all icing on the cake for Erdzundel. This is really wasn't my job. My job was to determine whether or not the mechanical stuff would have been feasible, and it wasn't. Gamma doesn't seem to understand that. He thinks that I was sent there to do a chemical analysis, and of course I'm not a chemist. My hat is off to him because he did a far greater job in his report on the chemistry than I did. But there are some other problems too, and I feel sorry for Gamma because Gamma grew up in the environment in occupied Germany, and Germany is still occupied today, despite what most people in the United States think. Germany is still an occupied country. There's still U.S. military all over the place in the country. It's unfortunate, but it's true. The first two generations in Germany, the Allies did what they call denazification. They trained the two generations in schools to not be National Socialists. But the next two generations after that, and I believe it's still going on, they were programming the youngsters in Germany. And this is where I think Gamma came along. They're programming them to dislike the Germans, period, to hate themselves, and to believe that the Germans committed some kind of a crime here. Now, Gamma said that the Auschwitz was a death camp, but it wasn't a murder camp. Well, yeah, a lot of people died. People died in all concentration camps. But the problem is there was nothing here that the Germans deliberately did. The Germans at the concentration camp had three bouts with typhus. Typhus is a killer. The first one they succeeded in putting down. There was another one that came along and they succeeded in putting it down. And then the third one they did manage to put down as well. The problem is that every time they shipped in the Jews from the ghettos, the Jews were loaded with lice and they brought typhus with them. and typhus spreads like wildfire. But this wasn't the fault of the camp administration. The camp administration did the best they could. In fact, the German government removed one of the commandants because he had too many people dying of typhus, and it wasn't his fault. It's brought in by the inmates when they were shipped to the camp. So, unfortunately, what we have here is we have, Gamow was the second or third generation that had been trained to hate Germans, at least hate the Germans that were running the concentration camps during World War II. And this is very unfortunate because they were being forced to hate white people, their own people, their own citizens. And the denazification, if you will, and the brainwashing has gone too far. And this is a problem with all of the Germans today. Most of them don't understand what happened during the war. They don't understand the problems that their people faced. And there is absolutely no responsibility to the German government for the fact that people died of typhus, except for the fact that they were running the camps, and they did their best to control them. And probably the typhus would have wiped out the people living in the ghettos anyway. So there would have been just as many dead, except in different places.
Very interesting. Yeah, and you know, one of the most, kind of like amazing aspects, you know, really, you know, I've read a number of, you know, revisionist books about the alleged Jewish Holocaust. And one of the things that comes out is that the German authorities at pretty much all levels, but certainly the ones that were actually running the camps themselves, they were very much concerned with the health of the inmates and their well-being and making sure that they were doing everything in their power to, you know, create like a healthy environment. And I think that comes through. I mean, the whole idea of Zyklon B being used to kill all these people, it's actually the reverse. They were actually using Zyklon B to like delouse the facilities, to delouse the clothing. So it was actually used to save these people's lives, not to kill them. So everything's sort of been turned upside down. And the whole narrative is actually like almost 100% opposite of what we're led to believe.
Yes. I mean, you know, Zyklon B was used for delousing, but it actually wasn't used as much as people seemed to think it was. They also had steam delousing facilities, and it was steam delousing facilities that they used mostly at the transit camps. They also had microwave delousers that they had at Auschwitz and Birkenau. So they were a step ahead of the Zyklon B. Zyklon B was primarily designed for small area delousing. It was made for use in closets where they could pump hot air through the chalk pellets that the hydrogen cyanide gas was absorbed in, or they also had discs that had these pellets in them. And you have to have warm air. It's got to be above 73 degrees, or else you don't get any what they call sublimation. In other words, that's the vaporization of the gas. And it has to be pumped out through the facilities to get it done. I found that in the areas where they should have been using Zyklon B, and they were required to use it under International Red Cross health regulations, they didn't use it, and probably was because they didn't have enough. After 1943, the Germans were dealing with a situation that they had problems with shipping. The Allies were bombing rail lines. The Germans also running out of supplies. We bombed the Zyklon B factories. So the bottom line is they didn't have enough Zyklon B to even use it to fumigate the locations that they should have done. And then that's not a problem for the Germans. That's a problem. The Allies caused that. But nevertheless, not as much Zyklon B was used as people seem to think it was used. And it was only used in the locations where they needed to do the extermination of the lice and the vermin in small closet areas. I listened to Gamow when he was talking, and he is upset with the German people, period, because they allowed this to go on. And I don't know that they had any way to control what was going on. None of the Germans, or the bulk of the Germans today, don't seem to realize what happened during the war and after the war. The genocide occurred with Eisenhower's Rhineland Meadow camps, where they starved over 1 million German soldiers to death out in the open environment. I mean, what happened after the war? I mean, Eisenhower tried to change the status of the German POWs to criminals, so we could put them in prison and destroy them. And the American military said, no, wait a minute. If a power that wins a war has the right to change the status of a prisoner of war to a criminal, that means that everybody fighting the war, the good guys, the bad guys, and whether you're good or bad depends upon whether you won and on which side you're on. It simply means that anybody is fair game. And anybody can be punished and executed for what was done. And the military was exactly right. What happened at Rhineland Meadow never should have happened. All those German soldiers were murdered. So, I mean, that's where the major problem was. That's where the genocide was. The same thing happened when they bombed Dresden. Over the Valentine's Day holiday in 1944, the groups of Allied bombers firebombed the city of Dresden, which never had any inkling of being any type of military hardware producer. All it ever produced was China. The city had no military people in it. All it had in it was refugees that were running from the war. It had old people. It had women and children. And the bombing of Dresden never should have taken place. It didn't help the war effort, but it was the attitude of Churchill and some of the higher officials, Barbara Harris, if you will, in the British military, and they twisted the arm of the U.S. Air Force into working with them. They bombed all these helpless people. They murdered over 1 million people with firebombs over a two-day period, which was just a total disgrace. Nobody is supposed to kill non-combatants. You're not supposed to kill women and children and old people and refugees. But that's what they did. But Germar doesn't see this. He doesn't understand this because he's been programmed to hate Germans. And it's a shame when you take a group of people and make them hate themselves. That's a terrible thing, and that's what's happened. There are a few Germans today that don't feel that way, but the bulk of them have been programmed to hate what's going on. Now, we use firebombs in other places. We used them early in the war in Hamburg, but we were bombing military inside. We were bombing docks. We were bombing sub pens. We were bombing all kinds of things. A military target is a military target. The United States pretty much stayed away from the targets that the British chose. The British liked to kill people because the attitude of the British was, we want to destroy the will of the German people. The attitude of the U.S. Air Force was, we want to bomb military targets so there's no ball bearings, there's no places for the military to stage, you can't get military hardware to the various locations. They wanted to slow down the war effort so that the soldiers, when they invaded the continent, weren't fighting a large, heavy force that was well-equipped. That made sense. But, you know, there were a lot of war crimes committed during the war, but they certainly weren't committed by the SS at the concentration camps. They were committed by the Allies doing things that they shouldn't have been doing. And primarily, right. I lay that at the feet of Churchill.
Yeah, see, yeah, that's another, you know, amazing aspect of revisionism in general that brings to light, you know, that and it's even admitted even by like mainstream historians now that there was no official policy, no statements, no, you know, written policy by Hitler or by any of the top, you know, NS officials specifically outlining and putting into place a, you know, extermination program to, like, murder all of these Jews systematically. That, you know, there's no documentation, there's no evidence of this. On the other hand, we have all sorts of very real evidence that the official policy of the Allied governments, mainly the British and the Americans, even the Soviets, was basically to genocide the German people, the German nation, and to extinguish it from the face of the earth, and that's exactly what they did. So again, it's a total inversion of the official narrative.
That's very true. That's very true. And it's a shame, because after the war, it went beyond what it should have done. It went beyond just defeating the enemy. It tried to destroy not only the German nation as a nation, but destroy the German people as a people. And that wasn't the reason for the war. I mean,
right,
there are
yeah.
a lot of reasons for the war, but I mean, one of them is not to destroy a people or a race.
And well, I mean, I think that there were all sorts of Jews that were specifically saying that leading up to the war, and certainly during it. And, you know, there's all sorts of quotes, and even if you look at, like, some of the people that were in, like, the FDR administration, they were Jews, and they made plans to systematically, you know, basically destroy the German government, the German people themselves, even.
They certainly did, but this is one of the problems. They should let the military fight wars, and the politicians should keep their nose out of it, and they didn't. I mean, you could tell what the military felt. You could tell what General Patton said. He said, we fought the wrong enemy.
Right.
We shouldn't have been fighting Germany. We should have been fighting Russia. We should have been fighting the Bolsheviks that were responsible for all this stuff. And these Bolsheviks were the same people that were advising Roosevelt. So, you know, the military wasn't listened to when it was spoken to, when they spoke to the politicians. We did the same thing with Japan. Now, after Japan was pretty much defeated, it was isolated to the islands, they expected that the Japanese population was going to fight when the U.S. Army landed. And they probably would have, because the war party had sufficient propaganda, so the people didn't really understand what was going on. And we utilized the atomic bomb in two cities to make it clear so that the emperor was able to take control of his country again. But the problem we have here is that we didn't need to open the atomic can. Curtis LeMay, who was the general in charge of the bombing, he was in charge of the atomic project in the Pacific. He made a special trip to Washington, and he talked to Truman, and he said, "Look, we don't need to do this. In less than a month, I can bring Japan to its knees with conventional firebombs, and we can do it in places where it won't be the same type of thing as wiping out entire cities. I mean, it's a disgrace." The fact that we had to use atomic bombs. I mean, you know, the United States says we don't shoot first, we don't do things first, but here we did something just totally awful. And the purpose of it was right, but we had other means, and we didn't utilize those other means. And that, again, is because you have Harry Truman, the man who said the buck stops here, but the buck really didn't stop there. He was following the same plan that had set forth by Roosevelt and by his brain trust, all those Jews. They wanted everybody we were fighting burnt to death.
Right.
And that's what they did. That's what they did. And I mean, it wasn't just in Germany. They also utilized it in Japan. But I mean, I think it was a disgrace that we used atomic bombs when we could have done it without it.
Right.
I don't have a problem with using a weapon if you need to. But we didn't need to. And after the war in Germany, we didn't need to reprogram all of the German people. We didn't have to turn them into a society that hates itself, which is
what
we
did. I think the main thing that they were trying to do was stamp out, you know, like any form of nationalism in the West. That's really kind of what World War II ultimately led to, is the triumph of globalism and communism, international capitalism, international communism, over nationalism, over national socialism, essentially.
Right. But it was led by the same people that had killed the Tsar's family in Russia. It was led by the Bolsheviks.
Yep.
And the Bolsheviks were the ones that were advising Roosevelt. So
yeah, exactly. And that's very, very well documented, even by mainstream historians today, is, you know, how thoroughly infiltrated the United States federal government was under the FDR administration by outright communist agents, right?
Yes, but they don't teach it in school.
Right, yeah.
The average American doesn't know it. And when you tell them, they look at you like you're crazy. The average American doesn't know about Rhineland Meadow. The average American, when you tell them they wanted it, Eisenhower wanted to change the status of the POWs to criminals, they look at you, well, that's not possible. We wouldn't do that. These people weren't criminals. They were soldiers. You know, but yeah, it works. That's what they did. But they managed. I mean, we're trained. The people in the United States have been trained the same way, but not to the same extent. We don't know what the average American doesn't know what happened during World War II.
Yeah, no. All they know about is the alleged Jewish Holocaust. I mean, that's really the way really the way World War II is presented, is Hitler, Germans, National Socialists, the Nazis were evil, and, you know, the Jews were persecuted, you know, for no reason at all. Of course, they never did anything wrong. You know, they were just irrationally persecuted and hated by the Germans, when in reality they had and see, that's the thing. If you study National Socialism, if you read a book like Mein Kampf, or really, you know, look at what Hitler was all about, right, what he was saying to the German people, what their policies were, they were clearly identifying the Jews as these hostile, subversive aliens. You know, they weren't part of the German nation. They were like a distinct alien group of people, as they are, you know, all over the world. They form their own, you know, nation everywhere they go.
Yep.
And they work to undermine and subvert the country and advance their own interests, oftentimes at the expense of the nation. And they were saying this and explaining it to people and making moves to stop it. And that meant isolating them and you know, removing them from society. And it wasn't a murderous, genocidal thing that they were doing by any means. It was simply just a way to prevent their country from being destroyed.
Right. The Jews have been thrown out of every country on the planet. And that's because, not because they were disliked, but it was because they fomented revolution wherever they were. I mean, Titus destroyed the temple in Jerusalem and dispersed the Jews simply because of that. No place on the earth was there any better place to live than the Roman Empire. If you paid your taxes and set up a Roman citizen, that's all you had to do. But they weren't going to sit still and let you foment revolution and kill Roman soldiers, which is what was going on there. But on the other side of the coin, the Holocaust never happened. It was not the intent of Adolf Hitler to execute and destroy the Jews. It wasn't a genocide. He wanted to deport them. And ultimately, he wanted to deport them to Madagascar. At least that's what the plan was. If you look at what's happened at places like the Wannsee Conference, but the bottom line is some of them left before the alleged Holocaust occurred, and two ships went out loaded with them, and they were refused every country that they tried to make port in because nobody wanted them.
Including the United States, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, he wanted them out of Germany. He didn't care what happened to them. He just said, look, everybody leave. I don't want you people here because you're a problem. And think of what he changed. After World War I, they chopped Germany up into a million pieces. They turned Germany during the Weimar Republic into a cesspool of sin, of disease and of crime. And he straightened it all out when he came in. He passed laws and he stopped that. And he said, you people that have done this thing, I don't want you here. Leave, please. Get on these boats, go someplace, but I don't want you here because you're destroying Germany.
Yep. And that's right.
But, you know, that's what they don't teach that in the history books. I didn't even get that when I went to school. And when I went to school, they didn't teach the Holocaust because they weren't ready for it. nobody had any idea of what they were going to do until later. So, but as I say, what they did to Germany was just a total disgrace, because they went beyond denazification. They went beyond stamping out National Socialism. They stamped out the people, they stamped out the children's understanding of their own heritage. They attacked and they stamped out the white race in Germany. And that was not good. It was bad, and it was disgraceful.
Yeah, and you know, you think about it, they did it violently against the Germans in World War II and after World War II, and they've basically done the same thing in throughout the entire Western world, using like cultural Marxism and, you know, the media and brainwashing and fake history and distorted history. And really they've weaponized our historical narrative against us, basically. And I think the official World War II narrative, and specifically the fake Jewish Holocaust narrative, is instrumental in all of this.
Yes.
So
It certainly is. And what's happened has just been a total disgrace. And at some point, we've got to pull our socks up and we've got to stop them, because it's all moving toward the NWO, the New World Order. It started in earnest with the Russian Revolution, and it's still rolling. And now we've got problems with the COVID virus. We've got all kinds of other problems. They're just diversionary things. They're means of locking people down and keeping people from discussing things and talking to each other. I mean, they would not be happy with us talking here now and what you're recording and what I'm saying. And I'm not saying anything that I'm not against any of the Jews. I'm not an anti-Semite. I'm just talking from a historical standpoint. I see what's historically happened, and I'm telling people what did happen and what we have to do to change that. So,
right.
And I think you are too.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm just trying to be real about what's going on and you know, what has gone on. So getting back to your report, the report you put together for the Zundel trial, I mean, you basically concluded that after your investigation, which was primarily from, you know, a structural or engineering perspective, right? Like you were examining the actual structures there in Auschwitz, Majdanek as well, Birkenau. Those were, I think, the three main camps that you were investigating.
Yes.
And you basically found that just looking at their design, the fabrication of the facilities, there's simply no way that they could be used for execution purposes, specifically using, you know, gas, Zyklon B or other poisonous gases, and that the overall narrative of these death camps is just simply not true from just a straight up engineering perspective, right? So that was kind of like go ahead.
Go ahead. All I was saying is what I tried to do, and it probably wasn't fair to Ernst Zundel, but in the long run, it helped him. I tried to turn the places into gas chambers. I tried to make them. What do I have to do this? And I said, I got to tear everything down and start from scratch. None of this stuff could ever work. Okay. And there's something else that I should mention to you, that most people don't realize, and it hasn't been publicized, even though I've talked about it in a number of places. After the everybody agrees, and all of the experts on the Holocaust, even the exterminationists, agree that there were no gassings any place but Poland. Well, all right, let's talk about Dachau. There's a gas chamber, alleged gas chamber at Dachau. I was sent there subsequently after the trial by Ernst Zundel to investigate. I did that in a couple of other locations, but Dachau is very interesting. As I've said before, Ernst Zundel hit me with a barrage of information, and it took me a long time to. I became an expert on the Holocaust with the information he gave me, and I started with no knowledge of it at all, and. One of the things that he did, he gave me the congressional record, because after Dachau was so-called liberated, the Eisenhower brought over all of the Congress and senators, all of our Congress over there to see the gas chamber that existed at Dachau that was never used. They said, well, they built it, but they didn't use it. And they sent everybody to Mauthausen. Mauthausen had a closet that was supposed to be the gas chamber, which was ridiculous because the one at Dachau was large and spacious. Well, when I examined the facility, I mean, I found that the gas was supposed to have come out of shower heads. There's no piping for it. They were just metal soldered together things in the shape of a shower head mounted in a concrete ceiling. I was up on top. There's high pressure steam lines that if it was used for gas, that would have probably blown the building up. There's a big vent in the wall of the gas chamber, which you can look through from the other side. It was never connected to any pipes. But the interesting thing about it is Ernst Zundel gave me all of the congressional record from what Congress did when it visited there. Now, Congress may not know what it's doing in most cases, but they're experts at documenting things. They measured all of the areas in and around the gas chamber at Dachau, and they all these dimensions were preserved by vote. Well, I had a copy of it, and when I read it, none of the dimensions even came close to the dimensions that I had. Remember, when I went any place, I took a draftsman. We used a compass to determine direction, and we made measurements, and we drew up drawings afterward that were given back to Ernst Zundel of the facilities that we're at. But none of the dimensions made any sense because they didn't match. They weren't off by 6 inches or 8 inches. They were off by 3 and 4 feet. Well, that's because they didn't care. They didn't figure anybody would ever check them. Because Ernst said to me, there's something strange here. He said, I remember reading an article about somebody saying that they built the gas chambers. Well, he finally found it and he sent it to me. Two American soldiers who happened to be carpenters came in after the camp fell, and they built a gas chamber out of wood and paper, which Eisenhower brought the senators and the congressmen in to see. And of course, nobody checked where anything went. Nobody checked if there was plumbing, if there were exhaust fans or anything else. They just came and they looked at it and they took measurements. Well, what finally happened is after they left, they tore everything down and they rebuilt a so-called permanent gas chamber that had beautiful tile in it. It had shower heads in the ceiling that allegedly had gas come out of them. Nothing worked, but it looked good. It looked good when people visited. And this is what happened. Eisenhower built first a phony gas chamber to show Congress, and then after they left, he had a permanent one built as a memorial to something that never happened. And most people don't even realize this, that the alleged gas chamber that was at Dachau wasn't even part of the concentration camp. It was built by Eisenhower. So, I mean, what happened here is just a total disgrace. Remember, Eisenhower was Jewish, and he was supporting the Jewish philosophy and what they wanted to do. And the same as he did in Rhineland Meadow was the same thing he did there. He created something that didn't exist. And it was only by accident that we found that out.
But interesting, yeah. It's incredible just how, the whole entire official narrative is just so fraudulent from every single angle you look at it, if you're doing it objectively anyways. And see, in my mind, the revisionist community over the years has like firmly and conclusively debunked the official narrative in every single aspect. I don't even think it's worth debating anymore. I mean, the official Holocaust story is just not true. It's based on fake evidence, false testimony, in some cases, just totally ridiculous testimony that has just been taken at face value. You know, Hollywood propaganda. Look at all these Hollywood movies. And you see that really like in the 90s, I think, is when you started seeing a lot of the big Hollywood movies come out, like reinforcing and doubling down on this narrative. And that's how people know about World War II, is from pop culture and Hollywood, basically.
Yes. And none of it's true. They, you know, they even throw this stuff in into television shows that they make today. It's got nothing to do with the show, but they just add it to constantly remind people that there was a genocide that never happened.
Yeah. And it, well, you know, one question I wanted to ask you real quick before we wrap up, really, is your report, this was in the late 80s, right, when you released your report and testified in Zundel's trial. How did your work? How did your work in this case specifically? I mean, how did it impact you professionally?
Well, the Jews came after me later, and they effectively put me out of business. They threatened prison wardens and prison officials. Jewish legislators passed laws so that the Department of Corrections in the various states couldn't deal with me. And what they wound up doing was they wound up torturing inmates because they didn't have any capability to do it right. A number of the states that were afraid to deal with me and had laws passed against me, the wardens called me up privately. And while they were vilifying me, the same wardens were vilifying me publicly, they were asking me for help. I sent them equipment and parts for execution equipment that I paid for out of my own pocket so they wouldn't torture people. So, I mean, there was a double standard going here. They were afraid to talk to me, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. What mattered was the fact that they got the executions done. But now it's gone beyond that because there's nobody on this planet that's familiar with how to execute people. All of the lethal injections that they're doing lately are going bad. The European Union has refused to sell sodium pentothal that we use for operations to the states if they're going to use it for lethal injection, which is one of the prime chemicals that he used. And as a result, they said, if you continue to use it for executions, we're not going to send it to you so you can use it for normal operations. So what's happened is they're using the wrong chemicals now, and they're torture. Everybody that's being lethally injected now is subject to torture. And so, I mean, it's just a disgrace what's happened, because as an expert witness, I should, you know, I'm part of the legal system. Lawyers, judges, legislators, these people are supposed to be able to say what they have to say to get their job done. To silence them causes the system to totally break down. If an expert witness can't testify in court because somebody doesn't like what he's saying, it destroys the court system. But these people don't care. They don't care about destroying the court system. They don't care about hurting people that they're going to execute. They don't care about torture. You know, one of the things, you know, I spent 3.5 months in prison in Germany because I testified in Canada. I wasn't arrested. They didn't have a warrant. I went over to Germany to speak on a television show about electric chairs, and I was kidnapped at gunpoint and taken and thrown into Mannheim prison. But
wow, when was this? What year did this happen?
It was 2 years after I – it was 91, I believe. It was 2 years after I testified in court. And they charged me with the crime of defaming the dead. You know, the truth is not a defense in any Holocaust issues. But they did that for a reason. Because Ernst Zundel was going to go on trial the following year, and he brought me to Munich to appear in court, and I had to be voir dire, which is the procedure that they use with any expert coming into a court. He's questioned by judges and also by defense counsels and by prosecutors, everything, to determine his credibility and his expertise. Well, I underwent 2 days of questioning by three German judges in Munich, and they determined that I was an expert witness and that I was going to be able to testify at Ernst Zundel's trial. Now, this would have been the first time that anybody was ever allowed to testify about whether or not gas chambers could kill people in Germany. And what they did is, that's why they threw me in prison, and they charged me after I was in prison, because they wanted to soil my skirt so that I wouldn't be able to testify in Ernst Zundel's criminal case, because I would have now been a criminal in Germany. It's terrible what they do and how devious they are. It's also interesting to note that 2 years after I made the report, at Jerusalem University, the Center for Holocaust Studies, the rabbi who was in charge of the studies, made a comment that when he was asked, he commented that the Leuchter report was substantially correct. There were no gas chambers. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because the Germans were despicable people. I mean, that's a stupid thing to say. But the point is, they suppress it. But when put on the spot, they admitted there was nothing wrong with the report. The report was correct. But they weren't nice people. They were responsible for the war. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if there was a genocide. It simply matters that everybody thinks there was a genocide. So
right.
It's amazing. It's amazing the stuff that they suppress.
Yeah, no kidding. And you know, one last question. You know, you were so involved with Ernst Zundel over the years. What was the man like? I mean, he's certainly, if you know, I never got a chance to meet him or anything, but I followed his work over the years and have seen a number of his documentaries, and just seeing how he was so persecuted and yet still so heroic and courageous to stand up for the German people and to stand up for what's right, you know, standing up for the truth in general. What was the man like? I mean, you know, you got to know him and dealt with him over the years.
Yeah. Ernst Zundel was a very nice man. He was a pacifist, if you can believe it. But he was an American. He was a German citizen who was living in Canada. He eventually came to the United States, but they deported them. He was deported illegally. They scheduled a meeting that because he applied for U.S. citizenship. They had scheduled a meeting for him, but they never advised him to come to the meeting. Then they come out and arrested him because he defaulted and never went to the meeting that he wasn't told that he was supposed to be at. But Ernst Zundel was a pacifist. He didn't believe in war. But he did believe that the truth about the Holocaust should be told, and the German people shouldn't be the whipping boy of the Jews forever. And that's what he believed, and that's what he tried to do. And he died with the same thing, with the same intent. He died in Germany, and he wasn't able to, there was a gag on him. He wasn't able to talk to anybody. I never even called him after he was deported because I didn't want to get him in trouble. But he was a very fine man. He didn't believe in war, but he did believe that the German people should be exonerated because he knew none of this ever happened. When I was hired, I told him when I went to Poland, if I find that there were gas chambers there or that they could have been gas chambers, I said, I'm going to make that in my report. And Dr. Forreston was a little bit upset by that because he said, I don't know, do we want to use them? And then suddenly he was so sure that there were no gas chambers, he said, I trust Fred Lucha. He's an expert. Let him go. He said, no matter what happens, we'll live with what he comes back with. And I came back. He was absolutely right. And
yes,
I came
indeed.
Back and I told it like it was.
Well, good. I'm glad that you were able to do that. There's been a lot of people that have, you know, sort of caved in and just gone along with this fake narrative. So your work is important, and you know, you should be commended.
You know, it's not like I haven't had to deal with them. They firebombed my house. They rioted in front of the courthouse after they preferred charges against me. I was actually, when I was on trial in Malden, I was followed by two Mossad agents around the city, and I was advised privately by the state police in Massachusetts that these Mossad agents were there. They didn't know what their purpose was, but they had been advised by the CIA and by the State Department that I should be careful. I spun my car out, and I stopped the Mossad agents who were behind me. I stopped them in a spot where there wasn't a lot of maneuverability. I walked up to the window of their car. I pounded on the window, and when the window went down, I produced my 45 Colt, stuck it in the driver's face, and asked them what their problem was. At that point, I got these two very swarthy Mediterranean types, Middle Eastern types. They turned white when they saw the size of the muzzle on the 45. They put the car in reverse. They backed up over the sidewalk, smashed a fence, spun around, and left. And they never bothered me again. The Mossad could not afford to be in a gun battle with a citizen.
Wow, that's a fascinating story.
Yeah, but you know, as I say, I've had all kinds of crap. They even tried to bribe me. It doesn't work. I mean, I have a responsibility and I have a reputation to maintain, and what I say is the truth. I've testified in all kinds of courts on execution equipment all over the place, and my word is accepted down the line, because I don't lie and I do tell the truth. And I don't know where the quote came from, but this is my feeling. And I don't know who first said it, but I will say it here so you can understand who I am and where I come from. The shadow that man stands on at noon rises up to meet him in the evening. And all right. we have when we leave this life is our reputation and what we've left behind.
Yes,
that's our
indeed.
Only legacy.
Right. So. Very good. Well, very powerful interview, Fred. I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, we'll stay in touch and we'll have to do this again in the future.
Right. We can do that. Sometime, maybe you'd like to talk about execution equipment in general.
Yeah, that would be a good topic. You're certainly an expert when it comes to that. But, this was good. I'm glad you were able to join me.
Well, very good. I thank you again. You have a nice day.
Okay.
Let me know when you get this posted, right?
Yes. Yeah, I'll send you a link, actually. I'll get it going right now, actually, as soon as we hang up.
Very good.
Okay, thanks, Fred. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, John. Have a nice day.
Yep, talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.